Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. I am Paul Leffler, and if you're a regular listener to this program, you know that each week we visit with veterans of World War II. The idea is to get them to talk about what they did in that incredible time in world history, to preserve those stories for posterity, in the process honor them for serving and sacrificing in the extreme way that they did, and hopefully along the way too to inspire the rest of us to live up to that great and challenging legacy left to us by what's been called the greatest generation. I call the show Hometown Heroes because of the idea that no matter where you go in this country, whether you're in the San Joaquin Valley or anywhere else, no matter what your hometown is, chances are there's someone around you that you probably don't even know what that person did to secure the freedom that you and I enjoy in our country each and every day. So when I travel for Bulldog Sports, and we have Fresno State basketball coming up tonight against New Mexico State with a tip-off at 6 and pregame coverage starting at 5 here on KMJ, I like to catch up with veterans in wherever I go. This week, I realized not only does every hometown have its heroes, a lot of towns have a story that relates to World War II. Started out this week with a game in Ruston, Louisiana, where during World War II, it was the site of a prisoner of war camp. Camp Ruston housed the survivors of U-505, a German U-boat that was captured by American forces, led to a great intelligence harvest that helped them track down wolf packs of U-boats in the Atlantic and avoid them on further trips across the Atlantic Ocean. So Ruston, Louisiana and Camp Ruston played a role in the American and Allied victory in World War II. Made my way out here to the southwest where Las Cruces and El Paso are so close together. Las Cruces, New Mexico, home to the only federally funded Bataan Death March Memorial. It's also home, that area, to an annual march commemorating the Bataan Death March. And believe it or not, there were more survivors of the Bataan Death March from the state of New Mexico than from any other state. So I learn a little bit every time I take a trip outside our valley. And this trip also gave me the opportunity to visit with a man who's got quite the story, Abelardo Navarrete of El Paso, Texas, who's 85 years old. He survived a very close call in Europe, still has a piece of metal in his skull to remind him about it. He has a Purple Heart medal. He received the Bronze Star for taking out a German tank. We'll hear him talk about that. And more recently, he had a special visitor from across the Atlantic presenting him with the French Legion of Honor medal. He'll explain a little bit about that as well. So there will be plenty to talk about on this edition of Hometown Heroes. We'll try to squeeze as much of it in as we can, including the strong bond he had with a fellow soldier and how he has tried to honor that bond in the years since World War II. And before we take a break and then get to that interview with Abelardo Navarrete, I wanted to tell you about one more thing coming up Friday night at Sound Arena in downtown Fresno. At 7:30, the Fresno Monsters host the Idaho Junior Steelheads. And the connection to this program, well, at Celand Arena, they will have the U.S. Honor Flag. If you're not familiar with the U.S. Honor Flag, it's the flag that was flown at Ground Zero in New York City immediately following those horrible attacks on September 11th, 2001. So the flag will be at Celand Arena Friday night, and the Fresno Monsters are admitting any veterans, current active military, or firefighters, law enforcement personnel. If you fit any of those categories, you can get in for just $5 and get up to 4 members of your family in for just $5 on Friday night at Celand Arena. So I hope you'll take advantage of that and go see the U.S. Honor Flag. Okay, we'll take a break, come back with that interview with Abelardo Navarrete. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. My guest today, Abelardo Navarrete of El Paso, Texas. He's 85 years old, still a few months away from 86, and he has a pretty incredible story to share with us today, not just of his time in World War II, but some recent events that I think will be of great interest to you today as you listen in. But let's start in the beginning. I like to ask every veteran that I interview where he or she was on that very important day in world history, not just American history, but December 7th, 1941. Where were you and what do you remember about that day and how you heard about what happened that day?
I was in a little town by the name of Sierra Blanca. We were riding around, and we got the word that the Japanese have bombed Pearl Harbor. I was just a teenager at that time, and it was a Sunday afternoon. And we didn't think very much about it. In my mind, I figured that in 2 or 3 months, the war would be over.
Well, and your brother was already in the service at that time. Did you have any inkling that you might be joining him in military service?
Well, I didn't know too much about the service. I knew that he was in the Air Corps, but I didn't think, you know, that eventually we all would be involved in the war.
Now, how did Uncle Sam get a hold of you eventually? How long was it before you were wearing a uniform, too?
Well, Uncle Sam didn't get a hold of me. I got a hold of Uncle Sam.
You had his phone number, huh?
No, a friend of mine was older than I was, and he was called by the draft. So I figured, I'll talk to my parents, and I'll get into if he allow me to go ahead and volunteer, hopefully that I would avoid getting into the infantry. And what happened, I did volunteer, and I wind up in the infantry.
And it's pretty obvious why you didn't want to be in the infantry. A lot of the guys that went in the Air Corps or the Navy or the Coast Guard didn't want to be in the infantry for pretty good reason. You realized what the risks and hazards would be?
No, I didn't. The only reason that I was trying to avoid the infantry, you know, because I figured they would be walking. And if I was to get in the Air Corps or Navy, I would be in a ship or in an airplane. And that was the reason that I was trying to avoid. I didn't know that in the infantry, like this guy used to say, in the infantry, you can get hurt.
You can get hurt and you can get killed. And I know a lot of your friends did. And I know that's something that's been difficult. So many of the veterans that I talked to have taken years to deal with that and are still dealing with it. But tell me about when you found out what the infantry was all about. What was your welcome to the Army moment that said, you know what, this is not just a fun adventure for a teenage boy?
Well, I was inducted here at Fort Bliss, Texas, which is next to El Paso. And they give us a uniform and everything else. We didn't know at that time where we were going or anything. And out of the four of us that came from this little town of Sierra Blanca, three of us went together to the St. Luis Obispo, and that's where we joined the 35th Infantry Division. When we got there, we were assigned different companies, and I was assigned to L Company of the 320th, which is a rifle company. And we didn't know anything, you know. They put us it's supposed to be in a six-man hut, but there was about 12 of us in the hut. And it was a beautiful little town there in San Luis Obispo. And we start our introduction into the Army in close order drill and a little bit of, we used to go out on small hikes. I used to write to my parents and tell them how beautiful the Army was, that I was sightseeing. I'd never seen the ocean before, and also the different trees because there's a lot of farming around San Luis Obispo. And that was my introduction to the Army.
Now, you just said you went on some small hikes. Most of the guys that I've talked to that went through that experience are groaning and moaning about a 25-mile hike. Is that a memory that you have?
Later, that 25 miles came about. But originally, we went maybe on a 5-10-mile hike. Later on, when we started training for combat training, which was in Alabama, then the 25 miles, we used to march 25 miles every day.
Well, so much for not wanting to walk, huh?
Right. And you get used to it. As a matter of fact, I'm 85 years old, and I still walk 3 miles every day.
So the Army did you a favor?
Yes, in that respect, they did.
In other respects, they were getting ready to send you over to a combat zone. What was going through your mind as you realized that sooner or later It's not just going to be a 25-mile hike. It's going to be not knowing where we're going and having people shooting at us.
Well, first, you know, we trained there in St. Louis for baseball for about 4 months. And then we went to Alabama, Port Rocker, which is at that time was Camp Rocker. And then we start training heavier and got acquainted with what the artillery could do to you. And we were well trained. From there, we went over to Tennessee Maneuvers. We went over to North Carolina. From there, we ship overseas. But this time, we were pretty well acquainted, you know, with the the war was all about. And I guess not necessarily we hadn't experienced any combat yet, but we knew that what could happen to us, and we start thinking a little more about the war, what could cause to us, what problems it could cause us.
You know, you mentioned having signed up with a couple of your friends from your hometown in Sierra Blanca. A lot of guys that I talked to had those kind of ideas. Well, I'm going to join with this guy, and we'll stay together all the way to the end of the war. And within weeks, they were separated. What was your experience?
What happened, one of the fellas got hurt when we was in Alabama, so they discharged him. The other one, friend, he was in another regiment, and if you recall that I mentioned about mixing the...
Well, that 35th Infantry had been National Guard troops who were a little older, and they blended some of you younger enlistees with them?
Right, and he happened to go on to one of the National Guard regiments, and he stayed, and he got hurt on the sometime in July of 1944. And so I didn't see him anymore. Well, of course, I didn't see him, you know, during the war. But I knew that he was hurt at that time. And we really separated. Each one of us went different ways.
So your plans didn't work out the way you intended them to. You didn't have your friends from home with you. But how were you received, and what was the camaraderie that you did have with the soldiers you served with?
It was all right, you know. At the beginning, we start talking about where we were from and everything else. And of course, there was a lot of them that came from the big cities. And here I came from a little town that the population maybe was around 2,000, if that many. And they kept talking about the cities and everything else. And all I could do was just listen, because I didn't have much to say, and when about my little town, which I'm glad I came from a small town.
Well, as a small town boy myself, I will agree with you there, and I won't get sidetracked on my own theories about that. You mentioned July of 44 was when one of your friends got hurt. July of 44 was when you landed overseas in Europe, and I think we'll pick up there when we come back. We'll take a commercial break here, come back with the rest of Abelardo Navarrete's story from El Paso, Texas today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. My guest today is Abelardo Navarrete of El Paso, Texas. He's 85 years old. He served in the 35th Infantry Division in World War II. And when we left off, he was just about to head overseas with that unit. And it wasn't in Normandy, even though you landed a month after D-Day there. That wasn't the first taste of the war for you. The Germans got to you before you even got to France?
Yes, it did. As we were unloaded from the ship, the German Air Force was strafing it in that area. And that was, a welcome committee that the Germans had for us. And that was the little town of... it's this big city.
Liverpool?
Liverpool. And from there, we boarded trains, and we went to a city by the name of Exeter. We remained, and from there, we were shipped to Southampton. It's a a port in England, and from there we board a ship going to France.
What's going through your mind as this is happening? I mean, you're still a pretty young man, and haven't experienced a lot of this before, I'm sure. It had to be altering and really jarring to experience this.
Well, really, you know, it's you get all mixed up and you say, my goodness, I can get killed here. And so really, even without seeing the enemy, because like, say, the German Air Force, they strafe us as we were getting off the ship. And so we didn't know exactly, you know, what else was in store for us. But soon we'll find out when we got to France that we landed in Omaha Beach. And from there, the war really started with us. First thing I saw there in Omaha Beach, a bunch of ships, some of them were sunk and some were floating. And also you look at the different areas that they had balloons that looked like a zeppelin. And we didn't know what they were for. And they told us that they had cables. And the reason that to prevent the German Air Force to come in strafe, and if they did, they would hit the cable and that would be the end of that airplane.
So you're getting a taste now of what had been happening for the last month in that area. The aftermath was very clear. And within a month of that, you were facing some pretty dire straits yourself with your division. Tell me about Mortain, France, in August of 1944. And what started out as a rescue mission where your group was trying to find someone else, you ended up in need of rescue.
Yes, we were already, the breakthrough has already occurred, because the breakthrough happened in July. And we were pulled back to go to this little town of Mortain. Mortain is located in a hill. And the 30th Infantry Division had one of the battalions surrounded, and we were supposed to go there to rescue them. Well, in the process, we took the wrong turn and wind up being surrounded by the Germans. And this was in late in the evening, and that night we'd work our way back to our battalion. I was a first scout, and it's pretty lonely job to being a scout. You're out there by yourself, and hopefully you're, because the rest of your platoon follows you, and you hope that you know where in the world you're going, and that you can discover the Germans before they discover you. And for some reason or another, there was a certain odor that I could smell, and sure enough, when I did, the Germans would be there. I don't know what that odor was. Some of the fellas used to tell me that probably the leather. I said, well, do you smell it? He says, no, I don't. So that sort of made me, instead of perhaps maybe getting back to the platoon and being a regular rifleman, I told them about the smell, and so that made me more a candidate.
So you were uniquely qualified for that because you had an ability that the other guys didn't have. Did they heckle you about that at all? Did they come up with any nicknames for you because of that?
No, they didn't, but they knew darn well. It's the first thing they say, send up radio over there. He said, he can smell them. And sure enough, you know, that happened. But like I say, I guess the good Lord gave me that smell. Or that, and there in Mortain, we were headed, or rather confronted with, we didn't know who it was, but later on we were informed, the SS troops, which the elite of the German army.
So here you are, teenagers, and you're going up against guys who've had the best training and had been through all of this before.
Right. They also had, in a lot of cases, better equipment than we had. Their tanks was far superior to ours. And, of course, the German had years of experience when we only had a couple of days of experience in fighting the Germans.
So what are you armed with at this time? You have a rifle on your shoulder, and that's about it?
Yes, we had the M1 rifle, and, of course, you have your ammunition. You have your cartridge belt and a couple of spandoliers. You also have about four grenades, which they come in handy. And so you're well armed. Our rifle was a semi-automatic. You had eight shells in the magazine, and for the Germans, they had what we used to call a burp gun, which can fire much faster than our M1 rifle.
Can saw you in half in a matter of seconds with that the burp gun, the Schmeisser. So you told us that you could smell the Germans when they were coming, but you didn't tell us what you do when you smell the Germans and how you get away from them, and how did you make it out of this situation where you can look back in retrospect and say you were surrounded by some of the best that the German army had to offer?
Well, once I knew the Germans were there, I would go back and tell my platoon sergeant that where they were and everything else, and then the rest of the platoon would be alerted to be ready to have a firefight, because it usually is what happened. And at that time there in Mortain, the way we were able to get out was through the darkness. And the platoon sergeant asked me if I could go, and I said, see if we could contact the rest of the battalion, which was a wooded area. And by sheer luck, I was able to find them. And so we got the rest of the platoon, and matter of fact, the rest of the company, back into the battalion where the rest of the troops were.
Well, that's a relief. So you made it out of that situation. And I know there were some times before that in the previous month that had probably prepared you for that, with what you'd been through in combat with that 35th Infantry Division. You mentioned the German tanks and how they, in your mind, were superior to what the Americans had, but you didn't mention that you took out one of those tanks. But it wasn't with one of those grenades or a rifle. It was with something that I don't think you'd had any training on. Tell me about how you ended up wielding a bazooka.
Well, the bazooka, I've never fired a bazooka in combat, and I had very little training in the bazooka. The bazooka man, obviously, I guess he froze and he couldn't do anything. What happened, the Kestrels in France are about, 10 foot wide and anywhere from 6 to 8 feet high, and it's nothing but dirt. And so they have what we call a sunken road, and you can hardly see the top of a tank. And we saw this two or three tanks coming down the sunken road, and the last one apparently was having trouble because there was a lot of smoke coming out of the engine. And so I asked the platoon sergeant, what are we going to do? He said, we're going to do nothing. He said, we'll let the tanks go by. And when the last tank was having trouble with his engine, I said, what do you say we knock this one, use the bazooka and have your bazooka man fire? And he said, no, that kid froze. He says, he can't do anything. He said, you take it. And I took the bazooka. And you have to load it from the back of the, it's a tube. Right. And you insert the missile in there, and there's two little wires that you have to connect in order to fire the missile. And so as the tank was going by, it was still going pretty slow, and I took from the back In other words, I was firing through the back of the tank, and I aim at the track. And fortunately, I hit the track, and the track came off the tank. And then the guys that were inside the tank, Germans, they start getting out of the tank. They knew they couldn't go anywhere. And they were captured by the rest of the company. But it was lucky that I must have hit an area that it was pretty weak. Some of the guys says, no, he said, you didn't hit it. He says, he hit a mine. So I don't know. the tank stopped. That was the main thing.
That would be pretty good coincidental timing if it did hit a mine the same time you were firing the bazooka. So that's what happened to the tank, and the Germans were captured as a result of it. But what happened to you? I imagine that bazooka had a little more kickback than your M1.
No, it doesn't have a very much kick. That's the funny part of it, you know. Or you can see it pulls you forward, but it doesn't. It's not like the M1. The M1 kicks you back, and this one pulls you forward. But that was the last time I ever got close to a bazooka.
One for one. You're batting 1,000 on that one.
Getting back to rescue this unit, the Mortain is on the top of a hill, and we got there, another part of the regiment, and I think it was the 1st Battalion, they got there before we did, and the 30th Division soldiers were real happy, you know, when we got there, and we stayed there probably maybe a day or so. And this is the first time we received mail in the last 3 weeks. And I received a letter from my mother, and she was telling me, you know, what a good job we were doing. And I said, boy, you didn't know how close what I've gone through to. And of course, she probably had a good feeling as to what happened. And because I stayed in touch with my mother frequently. I used to write her, and the mail was Sanser, and you had to put it right down in the back whether it was Spanish or whatever language you were using. And I would write Spanish, but the officers, they just go ahead and sign it. They didn't even read the mail, so it wasn't Sanser, you know, but
But the censors weren't bilingual, huh?
No, they weren't bilingual, and they would once in a while say, "What you telling your mother?" I said, "Well, I'm telling her it's a great country here. We're having a lot of fun."
Well, it clearly meant a lot to you. I can tell by the fact that you still remember that so vividly, that it meant a lot to you to receive that letter from your mother.
Right. Yes, it did, and mail was one of the most important things that a combat soldier can experience. If they have a mail call and you don't get any mail, the rest of that day you're down, you know. But eventually you'll get a letter and you recover, and boy, you're real happy about it.
A taste of life in the service in World War II, how much it meant to hear from half a world away. Interestingly enough, more recently, Mr. Navarrete has heard from half a world away, a very different presentation that happened here in El Paso not too long ago. We'll talk to him about that, and also the close call that is easy for him to remember today, because he still has an ever-present reminder in his skull to think about. This is Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. As usual, the time goes by too quickly. We still have a lot of ground to cover with Abelardo Navarrete of El Paso, Texas today. We're going to talk about the souvenir he still carries around with him, whether he wants to or not, and something else that he received recently that is very meaningful to him. Let's pick it back up in combat in the European theater. You're with the 35th Infantry Division, and you're asked to go relieve some troops, only to find out that at the top of this hill they're in their foxholes, but they've already been killed by the Germans. So you're stuck there for a while, and then when the supply lines come back through and your group is ready to advance again, German artillery starts coming in. Tell me about how you got injured. You are a Purple Heart recipient, and what you still have inside your body from that incident way back in 1944.
We attacked on the 8th of November of 1944, and we were pinned down. There was a creek, and we were in taking cover there, and I saw where the fire was coming from, but my platoon sergeant couldn't, in the position he was in, he couldn't see it, so I went over to tell him, you know, where the fire was coming from in order for him to call for artillery. And so I was explaining to him where the fire of the mortars were coming from. A shell came in, and I didn't know at that time, and hit my platoon sergeant, killed him with that same shell. I was wounded, and I was evacuated to a general, originally to a field hospital, and then eventually to a general hospital. I didn't know much of what was going on myself because I passed out. And as far as recovering, as I got to the hospital, they apparently put a plate on my head.
So your skull was fractured by this shrapnel.
Right. Later on, some of my friends told me that the only thing that kept me from getting killed was the steel helmet, because the steel helmet really saved my life. Even as much as we dislike the steel helmet, it did came in handy for that time for me. And I remained in the hospital for about a month and a half, and then I went back to my unit.
Well, and you would do so just in time for the Battle of the Bulge, but I want to stop you here. You're talking about this as if it just happened, because I know you've had it in your mind for more than 60 years reflecting back, but I think to people listening, they say, holy cow, you had a hole in your head. They had to put a plate in there to patch it, and you easily could have been killed. I mean, I imagine that affects you at the time when you take stock and say, I came this close to not being here.
Well, that's true, but the reason I wanted to go back to my unit was there was a program that if you hit the Purple Heart, you could come home for 30 days. That's what I was looking for. So I reported to the first sergeant, and he says, now, ready? That program has been canceled, so get your rifle and get back to your platoon.
And bundle up, because it's cold. The reason that was canceled, they needed troops for the Battle of the Bulge, the coldest winter that Europe had ever seen. And I imagine you didn't have a bunch of heavy parkas and wool stockings and all the comforts of a ski resort.
Well, really, when I got back, we were in the Third Army, and we were not involved in the bulge to begin with. However, at this time we got involved. They moved us from on the southern part of France to a city by the name of Metz, and that's where we spent Christmas of 1944. And the following day, we were committed to the bulge to open up a road to the city, really it's a town of Bastogne, where the 101st was trapped, and we were successful. We didn't do it overnight. It took us about a week and a half, and it was colder. I've never been so cold in my life, and there was no sense in even digging a foxhole, because the grounds were so frozen that you couldn't dig anything.
A lot different than South Texas, where you grew up, when you're in the frozen European continent in December of 1944. You mentioned spending that Christmas in Metz, and of course Christmas is just a few weeks past now. Is that something that every Christmas now, you find those memories kind of floating through your head? I imagine that's a Christmas that's hard to forget.
Well, yes, and of course we had something unusual there in Metz. We had a hot meal, so it was... I remember that part. I don't remember. I don't want to think too much about what happened after that. But the road from Metz to Bastogne, it was something else, and it was the cold weather, I think, was worse than the Germans.
The weather was as big of an enemy as the Nazi Germans were, to be sure. Now, you survived that close call, and you still have a plate in your head to remind you about it. Have you ever thought about the fact that if that shell had been a little bit off, or if your steel helmet had been adjusted a little differently, that you never would have met your wife, your 9 children, and 18 grandchildren, and 4 great-grandchildren wouldn't be here?
Well, that's true. My platoon sergeant, he had a direct hit, or at least that's what I was told. And so it was very lucky that the helmet didn't. A lot of times the shell with the concussion blows your helmet away from your head. But mine, I guess, it somehow or another stayed in my head. And that's the only thing that really saved me.
God had other plans for you, and I'm sure you can look back now and see all those plans and be thankful for them, and I'm thankful that you're here sitting with me today. You mentioned what happened to others, and I know that's something that's with you too. No one can serve in the infantry without losing a lot of their buddies, and there was one young man in particular that you were very close with, and you even made a pact with him. Tell me about your relationship there and what the deal that you two made with each other was.
His name is Julian Diego. He's from Clovis, New Mexico. And we talk about when we got out of the service, I was going to be his best man when he got married. And also I was going to sponsor the baptism of his children. And we had a lot of plans, you know, and we were going to stay in touch. Julian was a big gambler. However, when we were on a boat from England to France, he threw away all his dice and cards and everything else, and he swore that he would never gamble again, which he never did. Also, he was a Catholic, but he never had gone to a confession. And I talked him into it, and I arranged with the chaplain and everything else, and that's one thing I'm proud of, that he went to confession, and I'll never forget.
And this is still obviously a very powerful emotion that he experiences. And Mr. Griego did not come back from the war. He was one of the 400,000 Americans who were killed in World War II. I understand it was a quest of yours to try to track down his family. Were you ever able to do that?
No, I didn't. What really, for a long time, bothered me, I promised him that either one of us would fall, that he would take the wallet and whatever belongings you have and dispose of them as you please. I didn't have the nerve to do that, and so it always bothered me. However, later in years, I went back to France and I visited his grave, and I had a big talk with him, and he forgave me.
Well, I think everyone can tell how cathartic that was for you and how powerful that relationship still is. And it occurs to me, not to make you dwell on such an emotional situation so long, but that knowing what happened to him and knowing how close you came to the same fate, did it have an effect on the way you lived your life, not taking things for granted because you knew you easily could have been just like your friend?
Well, yes. I went from a boy overnight to a man, and also learned how the responsibilities that one has, and which has helped me through my life. It's a heck of a thing, you know, to go through a war to gain some experience, but sometimes that happens.
I think a lot of the veterans listening will back you up on that and identify. Now I want to flash forward a few years. I know you did come back home. You met your wife. You raised 8 daughters and a son, and now you have the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren to prove it. But just recently, you had a special visitor from across the continent, from the Republic of France, and he had a special gift for you. Tell me what that is and how that came about.
Recently, on the 10th of December, a gentleman from France, he was the general consul, presented me with the Legion of Honor of France, which is supposed to be one of the highest awards. And I was real proud of it. And he showed his thanks, you know, from the people of France, in which I'm receive the medal, and I'm very proud of it.
And I imagine looking at that, and I know that was an emotional moment for you when he gave that to you, to thank you and so many other Americans for the freedom that they still have in France today, not to mention the freedom we have in this country. When you look at that medal, does it make you think of Julian Griego and all the other men you knew who paid the ultimate price for that freedom?
Oh, definitely, and they're the ones that deserve the medal, not me. I never consider myself a hero nor a brave man. The brave ones and the heroes, they didn't make it.
Well, I think some of our listeners might disagree with regard to your bravery and your heroism with the stories that you've shared with us today. I know we haven't had time to cover everything that you experienced during the war. Hopefully we've hit some of the highlights. But is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listening audience about the men that you served with, why you did what you did, and why we need to remember it here today, 65 years later?
Well, I had some real brave men with me and real good friends. And unfortunately, most of them have expired. The last one was a very good friend of mine, Carl Killemeyer. I visited with him for about 5 days in Columbus, Ohio, and we had a few beers, we played golf, we talked about our experience, and he was supposed to come and visit me the following year and spend a few days here in El Paso. However, Carl never made it. He passed away sometime in March of the 2000, and I'll remember him. And the last one that I got word that he was also a platoon sergeant, Mike Hayes, he remained in the Army and retired. And he was from Alabama, a fine gentleman. And he received the Silver Star, and he was a real good friend. And so consequently, that I know of, there's only three of us from the original company still alive. One lives in North Carolina, I can name him William D. Williams. And another one, Frank Mancuso, he's from New Jersey. And of course myself, those are the only three that I know of at the original company of 185 that are still alive.
Well, I think if they were here, they would all thank you for telling their story and for sharing these memories of what you and the men like you did in World War II. Thank you so much for serving our country, for having the courage to share with us about it today, and take good care of that medal and, more importantly, the memories that you have from your time serving our country.
I visited France in three different occasions, and one of them was when I was president of the 35th Infantry Division Association. And those French people, the way they greeted us, it was wonderful. We visited different cities that we liberated, and I'll never forget the reception they gave us.
Well, and I think that made it clear that they would never forget you, and I know your family won't either. That's Abelardo Navarrete, 85 years old, of El Paso, Texas, who's been our guest today. Speaking of his family, both of his brothers served in the military. He now has a granddaughter serving in the U.S. Navy. She was recently stationed at Lemoore Naval Air Station, back in our neck of the woods, and is now overseas serving our country. So we thank that entire family for serving this great country of ours. Be back next week at 1 o'clock with another edition of Hometown Heroes. Thanks so much for listening today here on News Talk 580 KMJ.